Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today's guest live in the studio with me, William English, is David Price. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon, William.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
David is an experimental writer or writer of experimental fiction, artist, art as writing, writing as art, as well as being a lecturer at CAS, the CAS, London Metropolitan University.
Yes.
Is that okay?
All of those
wrap
things.
It up?
And a mixture of them all at the same time.
Yeah. Okay. And in the past, when you've been on the programme, you have written things specifically for Wavelength.
Yes.
Under an umbrella title, I think, of, or am I wrong? You'll have to prompt
no,
me.
No, you're quite right. There's a series of radio plays I've been making, all of which are, in a way, an ongoing piece. So, shall I do a quick little précis of how
Absolutely,
and when they've
yeah,
appeared?
By all means.
The very first one in the series was made for was presented in a gallery. It was then broadcast on your programme. The second episode of the radio play was made for Wavelength. Another episode was made for the Art Rotterdam, the art fair in Holland. A subsequent episode was made for Wavelength. And then today we have the premiere of the fifth episode, also made for Wavelength.
Right. Okay. And they all have the titles of each sort of episode are a sort of play on words, aren't they, with depending on what the time and event is.
Indeed. Well, the title of each episode sort of more or less rhymes with its circumstance of broadcast.
Right.
More or less.
Could you give me an example? Like, you have to remind me what the last one was. It was a Knave Tenth?
That was one of the ones that rhymes with Wavelength.
Exactly.
yes, exactly. And the one that we'll present sort of later on in the programme today is called Stave Length.
Right.
And then you mentioned the notion of an umbrella title.
Yeah.
That's something I've been thinking about for the first time recently, because soon, hopefully within a few weeks, there'll be a kind of podcast form for all the episodes so far and subsequent ones, which necessitates coming up with an overall title.
Yeah.
And so that overall title will be, or now is, Pray the Old Way, as a sort of
right
generic, almost rhyme with radio play.
Right. Okay. But you are primarily what a writer, I mean, the radio plays are an adjunct to the writing, do you ever consider yourself a radio artist?
Well, I suppose a little bit more so the more episodes of this
right.
of this piece I make. I think it's a really fantastic form to work with.
Yeah.
It's something that we've talked about a little before, but, you know, I write a lot. I produce a lot of words all the time.
Hmm.
But something extremely different happens when those words are being written to be spoken by a voice.
Right.
Especially when that voice is kind of carefully recorded.
Hmm.
And it adds a new, definitely adds a new sort of dimension to the text.
Yeah.
So it's a form I'm sort of currently
playing
with.
Do you think there's any? I mean, I suppose some people might have a problem, or not a problem exactly, or they might question how an artist writing is any different from a writer writing. How is it different from literature? You know, the art as text. Is there a different approach? Do you not have to conform? Maybe you don't need to conform to the same rules that a literary person might.
I think that's true. You don't have to. Perhaps you have to think less about accessibility.
Mm.
Maybe in the sense of perhaps you can give yourself more permission to be very abstract and sort of come around to things more slowly.
But do you have any kind of? Do you think ever about the way that it looks as it the way it appears on the printed page or whether that text might appear on a gallery wall, say, or does that not come into it?
That does come into it a lot for me. There may be two aspects to this. First of all, I think an artist might have an interesting sensibility for describing the visual within writing, and that's certainly something that interests me.
Hmm.
But in terms of the appearance on the printed page, it's certainly something I think about a lot in the few of my texts that have become sort of paperback books,
hmm.
then they've always gone through quite a kind of careful kind of typographical process and page layout process. So it's certainly something I've thought about a lot.
Right. And the Fielders is your finished novel. Is it finished?
It is finished,
yeah.
Yes.
And that's sort of available. I'm clutching one in my hand here. And it has an ISBN number, and it's, I mean, it comes looking like a book, even though it's sort of, you might think, it's almost like a sort of conceptual artist book in a way, to look at the outside. It's very stark white with small black lettering on it.
It's sort of as simple as it could possibly be.
Right. Maybe I've asked you this on previous occasions, but I wonder if there's any ambition for the book to sell. I mean, could it ever appear in foils or something? I've probably gone over this ground before.
It would be very nice if it did, I suppose. Mm. Maybe ambition isn't quite the right word. It's not an issue that I'm pressing. It certainly would be very nice, and it would be interesting to know what sort of editorial changes or differences there might be.
Would you agree to that?
It depends what they were. I think inevitably it would produce an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, the Fielders in particular, it's a sort of long-ish novel.
Yeah.
And it sort of starts it starts in a very abstract way before the characters really take shape.
Yeah.
And I suppose, and that's a...
But it's not available it's not quite true. I did search for it on Amazon and the Advanced Book Exchange. It doesn't even under the ISBN, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't come through them, no.
But there is something called, I did eventually find it on something called Lulu.com.
Yes, Lulu.com is the company that does the sort of print on demand printing.
Oh, I see.
So, and that's the most sort of direct way of getting it.
So somebody can look it up, they look up David Price, the Fielders. And it's there for £10, and then it's printed on demand. Basically,
yes.
the publisher will print one copy, send it to you.
Yes,
I see.
Precisely, and it's on. Copies of it are on the odd shelf occasionally in art book fairs and so on.
Right. Yeah.
One of which we might mention, just because it's happening tomorrow. In fact.
Oh right. Okay.
Which is just that there'll be a few copies of it amongst a lot of other really interesting things on the shelves of the display by Luminous Books that will be within the set of sort of art and fiction-ish events taking place at Raven Row.
Okay.
Which starts tomorrow evening.
Yeah, under the... It's called the Plastic Words event.
Yes.
So are you part of that or in some sort of... Apart from having your book placed there, is it sort of a...
No. Not in any formal or performative way.
Just a few
copies of the book will be there.
Right, so that's interesting. So that's at Raven Row in sort of Spitalfields somewhere, isn't
it? Yes.
Artillery Passage or something like that.
Artillery Row, I think. Yeah.
So is there a kind of an upsurge of interest in fiction as art or writing as art, do you think?
I feel like there is. It's something a lot of artists are talking about.
Right, really.
Maybe one other thing to say about the Fielders is that since we last spoke, it's become a part of the archive of the Book Lovers Project, which is a sort of curatorial enterprise produced by an artist and a curator. One can simply sort of Google the Book Lovers Art and Fiction or something like this to find the project. But this, the Book Lovers is sort of an attempt to systematically catalogue novels written by artists. So on their website, there's a very interesting, long bibliography of many, many things.
Mm.
And the Book Lovers have been occasionally curating exhibitions or displays. And their archive is housed in the Mooka Museum in Antwerp in Belgium.
Right. So when you say, so they're books by artists, so presumably it's not their primary activity.
Yes, exactly, yeah. I mean, they're specifically novels written by artists.
Right.
Novels written by visual artists.
By visual artists, okay.
More specifically, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So should we move forward into... you're going to read something, I think.
Yeah, well, I thought it might be nice. It's something that we sort of talked about last time, but the sequel to The Fielders was and remains in progress, although it's now much more advanced along the process.
Hmm.
So I thought it might be nice to read a little from the very beginning of that
sequel,
which I should say is called The Pavilion.
Right.
And
of course, so there is a cricket theme throughout these.
The cricket theme is perhaps transfer. In The Fielders, a lot of the novel is sort of structured around, a lot of the narrative is about cricket to an extent, and a lot of numerical structures in the book sort of come from cricket.
Okay.
The sequel takes place about 10 years later, and cricket is not mentioned very much at all.
Right.
As we'll hear from this first section, billiards is mentioned a lot. However.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll just read from the very, very beginning of The Pavilion. Book One, An Editor Practices. The white letters on the cushions of the old billiard table were laid out alphabetically according to the surname of their addressee. Bain, Cohen, Crome, Deman, Doos, Fish, Four, Hussein, Monto, Sam, and Whitefort. Each envelope was identical and was addressed by an identical hand in green ink. The letters were not stamped. The billiard table itself was diagonally situated at the centre of a marble-floored ballroom, the walls of which were decorated with friezes. There was some distance between these walls and the billiard table, and the friezes were painted at a scale to be seen from this distance. This was an occasionally distracting element to be taken into account when engaged in play. At the centre of the wall, nearest the left corner of the table's bulkend, there was a green sofa and a small drinks table, next to a rack for cues, rests and extensions, and a small shelf for chalks, ball cleaning cloths, and a magnifying glass intended for the confirmation of perceived touching balls. The drinks table had set upon it a cut crystal glass of the kind intended for sherry, but which was filled with vodka. It was the late morning, hence the choice for more pure sort of refreshment. A long pipe sat with its bowl leaning on the inside edge of an ashtray and with its stem resting some inches away on a small porcelain rest of the kind more commonly used at table by Orientals when pausing from the employment of sticks to eat. Section 1. Hector Tor was practicing alone at the table, using only three of its sides as a self-imposed limitation intended to improve his cueing from distant or awkward positions. It was for this reason that he had laid out the letters along one cushion, although he was obliged to distribute them to their addressees anyway, and so was killing two birds with one stone, or striking two balls with one shot, which may be a more resonantly local analogy, and so form a cannon, or a plant, to also take the terminology of billiard's variously coloured sister game. His practice session was going moderately well, although he had on several occasions made use of the rest to bridge over the cushion of correspondence, the name he had given to the exercise, amusing himself rather. He decided that this was not a means of cheating, as rest play was one of his great weaknesses, and so deserved to be practiced. He walked briskly to and from this rack to take and replace the rest each time the aid was necessary, drinking from the glass of vodka each time. His practice was punctuated, therefore, by refreshing departures from the table. More occasionally, he took these moments of pause to light the pipe, and in these instances made a ruminative circle of the table to smoke and inspect the internal geometry of the billiard ball's arrangement in relation to the table's cushions. He would then replace the pipe in its ashtray and stem rest, and return to the table, resolved to play one or another shot. The results of these shots were, over time, becoming more consistently successful. Without really meaning to, Hector had become a proficient player, to a great extent because the table had apparently been placed there to interrupt his passage around the building. I'll pause there.
Is that the end of that? That's the sequel. The beginning of the
very
of the sequel.
First page of the sequel.
Right. Okay.
Rather dense language to read aloud.
Yes. Do you play billiards?
Not billiards. I play snooker sometimes.
Pool?
Occasionally.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's quite a... I don't know whether that's just me, but it's. I get a sort of nostalgic feel from it. It's to do with smoking pipes and sort of cut glass and there was something to do with the drinks on a... Is it on a tray or something?
On a drinks table. Decanters and pipe rests and things.
It sounds, and of course, this setting of the pavilion is quite. It's sort of old English.
Yeah. Well, the Fielders took place, or the novel begins in 1917,
Right.
And then the Pavilion takes place approximately 10 years later, so in the late 1920s.
Okay.
With all of the same characters, somewhat older.
Right.
So there is a... There's definitely a kind of... It's not exactly the way I would naturally write, I suppose. There is a little historical stylistic layer added into the writing.
Right.
Hopefully when I give lectures to my students, it doesn't sound like that.
Okay.
Linguistically, it's kind of... It's based on sort of research and reading of literature of that time.
And why do you feel drawn to set the writing in these sort of earlier periods rather than in a contemporary setting?
That's a good question.
Mm.
I'm not sure that there's a rational reason for that.
Okay.
There was a lot of interesting art and literature happening during that time, I suppose. And I'm interested in sort of earlier avant-garde.
Right.
And in fact, as the Pavilion continues, the various characters from the Fielders reappear in it, but in the intervening 10 years, they have all become writers.
Right.
So in fact, the narrative of the sequel is sort of interspersed with either kind of reports on the literary careers of the characters,
right,
which is sort of gives an opportunity to make almost replica versions of a lot of different styles of literature from that time.
Yeah.
All of which kind of feed into it.
And in the previous radio plays, I think you always use the same sort of medieval music in the background?
More or less, or things that have a sort of similar musical quality. In the very first episode of the radio plays, the characters attend a party where medieval music is being played.
Right.
And then in the other episodes, there are other pieces of medieval or Renaissance music, but also various bits of music that somehow share a stylistic quality in my mind with that kind of music. A few examples of which we may get to towards the latter stages of this program.
Right.
I sort of brought in some examples.
Right, separate music tracks, as it
yes,
were.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, which you found inspiring because they relate somehow to the writing?
I'm not quite sure exactly.
Okay. But I found that it sounds very atmospheric when you hear the earlier extracts, episodes, with that sort of medieval music and people chatting. It creates a sort of very timeless ambience.
Hopefully so, yeah.
I haven't experienced it, but I think you were saying to me that there was a vogue for parties that played medieval music.
This is what happens in the narrative, at least, of the first.
Ah, so you've made that up, or does it exist in the world, like in the art world? Was there a fashion for people to have parties and play medieval music?
Unfortunately not, or not as far as I know.
I thought there was. Oh, I sort of thought that.
No.
I kind of like that idea, actually, the idea of people sort of, instead of having pounding sort of dance music or whatever, you'd have this gentle medieval music playing in the background.
Well, it's something that I sort of consistently try to start.
Okay, you started something.
Yeah, okay. But we'll see. It hasn't really taken off as yet.
Right, hasn't been reported anywhere.
No. But okay. in the very first sort of one or two episodes of the radio play, the characters are all together quite a bit, sort of having conversations in parties. And in a few of the other episodes, including the new one, it's a sort of moment... an almost in-between moment in the narrative where the characters are all apart from one another. And so they're all in slightly different locations.
Right. And do you always have a consistent cast of characters? You're following these same people through
Yes. Yeah. It's one new cast member has tended to be added.
Right.
With most episodes. Somehow it's just a... there have occasionally been times when the script has been prepared and then... it's somehow been difficult for one of the cast members to be there. And then it makes quite a fun literary game to then re-edit the script to perhaps give that part to a new voice and to rewrite it a little to account for the fact that it's a different voice.
Right. Appearing. And are they professional actors or artists, people known to you? Or?
They're all friends
and
sort of colleagues, but not professional actors.
Right.
They're people who the people who I know well and whose voices I know well, they also have very different accents to one another. So there's
right.
a sort of a,
okay.
I don't know, a sort of interesting, a sort of an automatic differentiation that happens. And I think we've talked about this before, but as soon as the first episode had been made, as soon as I began writing the second one, I was from that point on sort of typing with the given actor's voice in my mind.
Right, right, okay.
So the
so
nature
it grows
of all of their voices.
with your relationship. The story is growing as your relationship with these people grows.
Perhaps so. Although the story, the narrative, is pretty abstract.
Right.
In a way, I suppose it's the radio play pieces are they're more about the sort of quality of voice.
Okay.
Without. They don't really intend to sort of develop complex narratives.
Hmm.
It's really just hopefully sort of identifying something that quite interesting that happens when text is given a voice.
Yeah.
And the characters discuss their relationship to each other. But it's a sort of relationship of
so
voices.
So is it the sound of the voice or the what do you call it, the timbre or something, or the mood? Or?
It's all of those things, but it's also the way it animates a text.
Yeah. And is that more important than the text itself?
Yes. From the second it's spoken, it becomes...
Okay.
The second it's spoken by one of the actors, the script becomes a kind of... quite a bare object,
yeah.
in my mind at least.
And are there any...
normally I should say I'm someone who's in love with kind of text on the page. But in the case of these, you know, things being written for voice...
Yeah.
It kind of invalidates the text.
Really? Okay.
In my mind somehow, yeah.
And are there any precedents for that? Are you influenced by anyone that might have done a similar thing? Or is this come out of... You've just invented this or as a result of what your work, as it were?
I suppose that... I mean, there are other artists occasionally working with, you know, working with the radio and working with radio forms and sometimes radio play forms or dramatic forms... but these pieces weren't really based on any particular research.
No, but I mean this idea of the tone of voice kind of becoming more important than the text itself. I mean, can you think of other examples of anyone that sort of exploited that idea?
Well, it's certainly something that poets talk about. That's very
right.
different. That's them reading their own words. And maybe that's a similar...
But I would think in that case there would be probably quite a strong union between the voice and the words. I mean, it's like they would probably come together and create so that the reading is better than just reading the poem from a book, perhaps.
Yeah.
But in this case, you seem to be suggesting that your text actually becomes irrelevant almost and one should concentrate more just on the tone of voice.
Yeah, the text becomes a much... less rich element. The text on the page becomes a much less rich element than the text is spoken, I think.
And do you write the text in such a way that it becomes sort of... I don't want to use the word vacuous, but it creates a sort of vacuum in that the text, it's very carefully written, but it's going to be subsumed by something else.
Yeah, the text is carefully written, but it's written with a lot of sort of spaces built into it, a lot of sort of punctuation, dot, 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 or gaps and sort of pauses.
Right.
So that there's a lot of space for the voice to animate it.
Okay.
In fact, the script began with me attempting to write more or less the way that I speak. So
right.
the same kind of, the same sort of commas and dot, dot, dots and semicolons that I think that my voice has, just as a sort of an immediate source of spoken language.
Are you looking for anything in the tone of voice of these people that you use? I mean, what do you have anything... What are you looking for? is there something that you're trying to get to with this process?
And a sort of an open agreement to be part of the project, I suppose, is the only real criterion. Now that it's a few episodes in, when a new member of the cast has been added, then I suppose I've thought about there being a different accent
right.
being added to the piece. That's that's one thing. Although actually, in the case of this new episode, the newest cast member has a rather similar accent to the cast member they temporarily replaced.
Right.
For sort of, okay. Which is somehow explained in the
Do you want to name these actors? Are we going to go through a cast list, or do you prefer not to? Perhaps it's not necessary.
We can do. Yes. I can at least say hello to them all.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Maria, Marta, Ada, Franzi, Katerina, and there are more. You put me on the spot because yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Hello to all of them. Yeah, okay. Thank you to all of them.
Okay. Yeah. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is David Price. I still stumble on whether to call you artist, writer, artist, experimental narrative artist or something.
We can say all of them.
Yeah, all of those things.
In a list that trails off.
Okay.
We were just going through the cast members.
I thought you'd forgotten.
One of the cast members, the part played by Louise,
yeah.
is the one cast member who appears differently on the script. She sort of plays the radio announcer.
Oh, okay.
As opposed to
radio
an unnamed
script. Oh,
character,
okay.
more or less.
Right.
You know, the parts on the script, the characters are A, B, C, D, E, etc.
Oh, really? Yeah,
except
yeah.
for the okay. announcer.
Right.
Who's sometimes with the others in conversation, sometimes not.
Yeah.
But that's perhaps one slightly other element to it.
Right. So should we proceed with this, the next episode?
Yes. Yes, we should.
Okay. So this is episode 5 or 6? Or
five, yes.
Five.
Which is called
of this ongoing project, two at least of which were specifically written for this program.
Yes,
which is very nice. It's nice to have sort of texts which are just, you know, introduced on this program. And so this is the fifth episode. What's the title again?
Stave length.
Yes.
Stave length. A radio play stretched to a high level of tension. It may snap.
Snap. Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Snap.
Stave length is a term that could refer to two things. The first is the length of a wooden stave. The structure I am speaking from is constructed out of such things. This structure is a wooden raft, and I'm floating on an ocean of some kind. I'm not entirely sure why, but I have broadcasting apparatus, and this is all I really need to exist. So I'm relatively happy. Relatively. The second thing that stave length might refer to is the length of a musical stave. This could be of almost any length, I suppose, as all that distinguishes a musical stave is its parallel lines. They exist so that musical notes might be expressed on them, might be expressed by them. The length doesn't seem so significant to me. In fact, I disregard it. Where is that music coming from? It comes from a time before musical staves were written on paper.
Floating. This reminds me of something. It definitely reminds me of something. There's a recording made by some famous countrymen of mine. But they made it before they were very famous. They called themselves Organisation zur Verwirklichung gemeinsamer Musikkonzepte, which on the face of it sounds like quite a reasonable proposition. But what does it mean to float a tone? The word turn comes from the Latin tonus, which has something to do with the tension in muscles. I suppose there are some occasions when muscles float. It happens when a person is swimming, for one thing. It also happens when a person is trying to stay as still as possible, when they're trying not to move. This is what I'm doing now. I am hiding. But, in plain sight, I think that is the expression. Who can't see me? The one person who is really looking for me, she doesn't know what I look like, at least not yet. Well, well, enough of these riddles. I have work to do.
Where can she be? I've been looking for her for ages. The word hide has quite a few possible meanings, and I am forced to consider several of them. We appear to be engaged in a game of nascondino. Not to be confused with sardina. The name of that fish comes from an island. I don't need to tell you which. The fish play no such games. But, as I was saying, there are several meanings of the word hide, at least in this language, the one I'm now speaking in. Can you hear me clearly? Would you like me to speak louder? Or more quietly? I will do neither. I will continue to speak at exactly this volume and in exactly this tone. The skin of an animal. This is the meaning I'm most interested in. Why is it called this? Does an animal hide in its skin? I suppose it does, in a certain way. There are a number of ways to skin a cat, and I'm interested in none of them. I have absolutely no desire to skin any cats. But there are always a number of ways to do something. A number of ways.
Nobody will ever find me here. I wonder if they're even looking. I suppose they are. But they will never find me. There are... What am I saying? And to whom? It doesn't matter. We always end up asking questions like these, and the questions pass without being answered. They float onwards. Perhaps the time has come to stop all of this. How far can it keep going? How long can we continue, cast out and hiding like this? Wandering around and wandering about, without even much of a setting, totally displaced. Well, not totally. There is always something about a place that makes it a place. We're not in some kind of void, after all. That would be ridiculous. In fact, it would be preposterous. I'll keep hiding here for a while and see what happens. I'll see if anyone else passes by, but I sincerely doubt it. Unless it's someone we don't already know.
I'm still looking for her. the one that replaced me. We've never met, but she took my place for a moment. She had to, but in the process made it her own place, which is now a place of its own. I would like to meet her and ask her how it felt to enter whatever that place is. It is impossible, totally impossible, to understand how another person's mind works. It's hard enough to understand how one's own mind works, but the mind of another person is a different kind of mystery to that. The extent of my displacement, of all of our displacement, is becoming intolerable. What are we doing? Why do we feel like this? What kind of space are we entering into? And why, I should probably ask first of all, are we compelled to declare and disclose all this? Why are we just, seemingly, speaking our minds as if it were natural to speculate about the meaning of everything? I remember, when all this started, we were at least located in a world of sorts. And the words we first spoke to each other were breathed into a room full of people. And we could hear them as they heard us.
Our sound waves touched their skin. But now, it's as if we've been sent into exile.
I have decided that there's no reason to hide anymore. It might have been a sensible precaution at one point, but it was probably unnecessary. What's the worst that could happen? Being exposed in some way? And what then? Nothing. That would be the end, and nothing would really have changed. Everything would have carried on regardless. Our words have no effect on anything. They just happen and run along a back channel beneath the rest of the world, with its meanings and resemblances and resonances. There's no point in even thinking about there being a purpose to things. Who cares about that, really? So, I have made a second decision, which is to start doing what I want, and saying what I want to say, and disobeying any instructions that I don't feel like following. I feel much happier now that I've made this decision. When I do see the others again, if I see them again, I'll try to explain how this feels. It won't be easy, as it's really the absence of the feeling. It's the absence of gravity. It's a sweet vacuum.
You are listening to Framework, broadcast today as I speak. This is not the first episode of Framework, nor will it be the last. I wonder who can hear it. In today's program, I will be discussing an aspect of myself that I had forgotten, an aspect of my past. But before I do so, let me describe the scene before me. It is better described as an absence rather than a presence. There is little beyond plants and water. There is little in the sky. In the very far distance, there may be a trace of an aeroplane, but I cannot confirm this. It is very, very hot. All of my broadcasting equipment is hot to the touch. The dials burn my fingers. The needles on my meters move to the sound of my voice and flick with my pulse. The aspect of my past that I wish to discuss is not an easy topic to broach. It is a sensitive subject, not just for me, but for the others involved. It is, partly, the reason that I am here, and they are, wherever they are. They may be listening, they may not be.
So, she is still broadcasting. I knew it. I wonder if the others can hear her too.
Anyway, we cannot all be together at the moment. It's impossible. We have to hide for a while, although I strongly suspect that some might have come out of hiding and might instead be searching.
That was Stave Length by David Price. Was that written specifically for today, or is it something an ongoing... Does it have another presence somewhere else?
Specifically for today.
All right, great.
This episode.
I feel like, at one point I felt like the radio announcer should be here, almost doing the announcing.
Yes.
Like replacing me, perhaps.
Well, it gets, it gets slightly more complicated in this episode, I suppose. Lou, whose voice we heard at the very end of this play, in all the episodes she has been the announcer and has sort of made radio sounding interventions. In this new episode, the final section that she says, in fact, introduces a radio program of hers.
Exactly. Right. And so she talks about replacing somebody else, which she has done.
Yes.
So it's everything is sort of self-referential all the time, in a way.
In a very gentle and loose way.
It's now entered into this I feel like I'm being sort of supplanted in some way. And I could almost have imagined literally me leaving the studio and her carrying on with the program as though nothing had happened, and then it would have just continued.
Sort of yes, okay. It's true. I mean, this episode we just heard was 12 minutes long.
Yeah,
it would be perfectly plausible to add another half an hour to that, which is the character of the announcer delivering the program that was meant to happen in the first place.
It's very much a narrative that almost can't move forward, isn't it?
More or less. I would say in the third, we're now on the fifth episode, in the third episode that was made specifically for the Rotterdam Art Fair, then in that episode the narrative is literally moving forward because all the characters are gathering towards a port town.
Okay, right.
And they're sort of telephoning or writing to each other and assembling.
Right.
So I think that when there's a specific, a gallery or other kind of circumstance, the characters sort of move.
Suddenly they're all moving this slowly, gradually, with a purpose.
Yes.
In this one, they didn't seem to. They're almost like people. It's quite dreamlike, and they're sort of almost delivering monologues. Sort of, it's like they're talking to themselves, but to each other.
Yes, that's extremely the case in this new episode. Whereas I think, if let's say hypothetically, an episode of the play was to be made to be shown as a work, and it was the only work in an art gallery. Mm. I'm sure that in such an episode, the characters would be discussing that space in some detail.
Yeah.
In particular, when it's the episodes that have been made for the radio, for radio broadcast, in all of those episodes, the characters have been rather displaced, and sort of talk about being just existing on the airwaves.
Right. And what else? Yes, dreamlike. Totally displaced is a reference to a void.
Yes.
And even then she cancels it out because she says, she makes this statement about being totally displaced, and then she says, well, perhaps not totally. So everything kind of is in a state of flux, I suppose.
Nothing ever quite disappears. It sometimes goes all the way down to the level of an internal monologue, but never quite disappears.
Right. Okay. And is there an end in sight? Do these episodes progress towards anything finite? Do you know there are going to be 20 episodes, or is it just endless?
It's potentially endless. I certainly like the notion of it being very open-ended.
Yeah.
I think there's a big kind of formal difference, I suppose. If I'm writing a book, then there tends to be a point when it's finished.
Yeah.
And at that point, writing ceases and printing starts.
Right.
And there's a block of paper.
Yeah.
Whereas with sort of episodes of a radio play, it seems it's in its nature that it could be endless.
Right.
So I sort of like the idea of this. That it can be language that sort of drifts along.
Yeah.
Sometimes might focus on a particular circumstance, but can otherwise just sort of go along in the way speech itself does.
Would you ever want to do an episode with the actors in the studio here?
It's something we've talked about a little bit.
Okay.
And it would be a very nice thing to do sometime. It would make the process rather different. It would mean sort of rehearsing differently.
Really? Okay.
In the recording so far, like I say, the sort of interface with the text is quite close. The characters sort of have the text and almost replace it. It becomes a sound recording. I think for a live broadcast, the it would have to be it would have to be rehearsed in a perhaps a much more dramatic way, and right. that would change. Yeah. It would change it as well.
Do you allow them to ad lib at all, or is it very, very controlled? You know, are you basically the narrator?
Yes, I suppose so. However, quite often the various actresses almost sort of say perhaps say a word that's different from the one in the script, because that is what happens naturally.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, those are always totally apposite corrections, in effect.
Okay. So you don't jump on them and say, you shouldn't say that. It's
generally, I'd notice that there was a mistake and then almost very quickly realise it's actually a very good correction.
Okay.
So things get changed a little bit.
But there's no
room
for them to digress. They wouldn't be able to go off on their own tangent.
It hasn't happened so far.
No. Okay.
I'm not sure. Maybe it will. I don't know what would happen if it did.
Right.
But also, as the narrative has gone on, there are quite a few bits that sort of, where the script goes into another language spoken by a given actress.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And so, which are generally languages that I don't speak.
Right, and so those there were a few words there that I didn't recognise at all. I couldn't quite understand. She talks about a game of something, and then it's something to do with fish.
Yeah.
And play no such games. The word was completely alien to me.
I was thinking about the childhood game of sardines.
Oh, yeah.
That, as we play it in English.
Yeah.
And then the name for that game in Italian is Nascondino.
Oh, okay.
But then Marta, who reads that part, character D,
right.
Then she, you know, sort of her part makes some...
So it goes into her own language, that is that
yes.
her? I see. Right.
And then she makes some... little jokes about, I mean, sardines being from Sardinia.
Right, yeah.
being Italian. And likewise, in the Franzi's part from earlier in the play is talking rather tangentially about sort of early incarnation of the band Kraftwerk.
Oh, yeah.
Whose full German name I wouldn't even begin to be able to pronounce, but
it was a very long German word.
Organization. Yeah. Etc. But it's quite a long, full name.
Uh huh.
And there's one of the very early Kraftwerk tracks is playing over that section.
Oh, okay.
It's rather sort of abstract music.
Yes. Yeah. Some of it sounds like it's going backwards. Is that?
Yeah. There's one long section over which a few characters speak, which is one of the Bach oboe concertos backwards.
Right. Oh, right. Right.
For some reason, Bach's music is one of the maybe few examples of music that has equally beautiful melodies backwards.
Oh, really?
Okay. I'm not sure why that would be. The music is so melodically well ordered that it also makes sense backwards, apparently.
Right. So do you want to play this music track, something to do with some connection with Neu, I think, speaking of German? Or what? How do you want to proceed?
Well, I've brought in... We have 10 minutes left, so we can perhaps play two different songs.
Or is there some more spoken... Is there another text you want to read?
There is, but it would take ages to do. It would be a whole other subject.
Oh, okay.
So maybe it's nice to stick with the music.
Yeah.
A bit like the last time I was on, I brought a few examples of the kind of musical sensibility that informs the background music to the plays, and indeed which the characters discuss sometimes.
And perhaps we should mention now that you play in a band yourself.
Yes, and I brought in our band too.
Yeah, which was called, the track is called Poet's Poem.
The Poet's Poem.
But what's your track, your band called?
The Margins.
The Margins, okay. So what do you play?
The guitar, mostly.
Right, okay.
We, in the studio recordings we've made, we've swapped around just a little bit, but mostly the guitar for me.
So what should we do now? What do you want to play?
Seeing as we've been... talking about it, we could play the Poet's Poem.
Oh, okay, fine. Which, so again, this is by The Margins, your own band.
Then perhaps after that we can
round up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Poet's Poem by The Margins.
Yeah, one quick thing to say about that before we move on is this is one of our songs for which we can't take all the credit for the lyrics. The verses come from verses of sort of ancient Sanskrit poetry.
Right.
And then the lyrics to the choruses are the bits that we wrote.
Is that a harmonium?
There's a kind of keyboard solo in the middle, which is a Rhodes piano, but then the final couple of bars of it, of the same solo, are on a very old out-of-tune harmonium, a sort of foot-pumped harmonium.
Like a small organ almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sort of stops and things.
And it sort of picks up and wheezes the final part of the electric piano bit.
Okay. So you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with experimental writer and artist David Price. And we've had the premiere of Stave Length, an ongoing radio narrative, which maybe there'll be more episodes to
I suspect so.
And perhaps I'll become redundant when this other radio announcer takes over. Okay, so what's this last track you want to play?
The last track is another example of this sort of musical sensibility that appears in the radio plays, which is a track called Lust by Michael Rother, who was the guitarist in Neu.
Okay.
It's from one of his sort of 1980s solo albums that pursue some of these sort of repetitious melody ideas that Neu performed, and in his solo albums happen in a much sort of gentler sounding sort of funnier way.
Well, I was going to say the whole mood of your work is quite gentle. I mean, the
generally
the musical
speaking,
track and your narratives, there is a sort of gentle mood running through all of it.
Yes,
quite calming.
Yeah. I before we play it? Should I just mention the website where listeners might be able to hear more things by The Margins if they wish, which is simply themargins.us.
Okay. And then your own website
and
is...
My own artist's website is davidpricework.org.
Right. Okay. And then briefly, also, there is this show at Raven Row. Is it a one-off event, this thing, on Saturday?
There's a series... As far as I understand, there's a series of events, the first one of which is on Saturday evening.
To do with words and so on, called Plastic Sounds. That's at the Raven Row Gallery on Saturday night.
Yes, and there'll be a kind of display/shop from Luminous Books...
Which will include your novel, The Fielders.
The Fielders, and many, many other things.
Right, great. Okay, David, well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And we'll end with this, with Michael Rother.
Yes.
Yeah.